Today I'm going to talk about this double vajra, the Vishva vajra, as it's called, that this figure is holding in his left hand. And I'm going to be talking about it as a symbol for unification or integration. So the vajra like this, the single vajra, this is kind of essentially symbolizes the immovability or the stability of the enlightened mind. Because it's a Tibetan symbol, it has an enormous number of other symbolic meanings as well. They seem to manage to read or get just about everything into every symbol, especially the vajra. So you get ones with different numbers of these prongs. 1, 3, 5, 9, for example, different animals. So these prongs come out of the mouth of different types of animal, elephants or these mythical beasts called Garudas, and so on. So anyway, that's the vajra. It's quite, I find it quite interesting because the like a lot of Tibetan symbols, maybe Indian as well, they're a kind of translation of something that was comes out of a kind of setting of violence and war. And they're a kind of alchemical change to turning it into something that symbols something completely contrary to that. So, for example, there's a figure in Buddhism called Manjushri who wields a sword, and it's the sword of wisdom. So it's taking something that is a weapon of violence and saying, actually, you know, it's we kind of translate that symbol to mean cutting through ignorance to wisdom. And so the vajra is actually the same, apparently. It began life, as it were, as a weapon. It was a throwing implement, apparently. And these prongs, originally, they would have been like sticking out. They weren't curved in. And you know, by some kind of, not literal maybe, but by some kind of alchemical, magical transformation, the kind of the prongs kind of bent inwards and became this kind of symbol of the enlightened mind. In other words, the mind of wisdom and compassion. Also, I read that in Tibet, some of these vajras were, they're cast out of meteorites. Meteorites are called, well, that rock is called sky iron. And I quite like this. I mean, I've never actually seen one that is made, literally cast from meteorites, but apparently they exist. In the place where I was reading this, the author said, this isn't that unlikely when you think of Tibet being, most of Tibet is a very high plateau. In other words, there's less atmosphere, and apparently that's more likely that you'll get meteorites, you know, because there isn't so much atmosphere for them to burn up in. So that these rocks would have been gathered and then kind of forged, melted and then forged into this shape. So you get this ritual implement that is forged from sky iron. So it's come out of the depths of space. And you know, from the sky, and turned into something which is a symbol of something, you know, something kind of
tied on
immovable Buddha.
It might knock the candlesticks over, but anyway, it's alive.
Shane, hi.
Did you flap a bit then as well?
I just was writing away. I thought the tent was going, actually. That's when I started flapping. I know it's tied on.
Good thinking.
And so this, so the vajra, so then we come to the double vajra, if you like, which is simply two of these kind of fused together symbolically. And as I said, that represents unification of opposites, stability. And it's also a representation of the place where the historical Buddha sat under a tree and on this kind of May full moon evening, which was last week. And and gained enlightenment. So, and that's, that point is called Vajrasana, the seat of the Vajra. And interestingly, this tent is stored at the retreat centre called Vajrasana. So, to look at this idea of integration, first of all, what I want to do is just read a couple of sections from Sangharakshita, the founder of our Buddhist community and order. First he says, when he asks this question, what is integration? The first thing he says is, well, let's have a look at what is disintegration in terms of the person or the collective. So I'm going to, in fact, I can just read it. I wrote out the quotes, so I'll just read them from my notes here. So disintegration, he describes this as being the state of being split up, broken, fragmented. And he says it's reflected in modern, industrialised, urbanised, commercialised, computerised, programised society. In a way, we all know that. I mean, in a way, that's why we're here, isn't it? We sort of all know that. But he says that, I mean, I find this quite interesting, because he says that that society, that description of society, he thinks is because of an overemphasis on rational intelligence, standing by itself, broken loose from the rest of the psyche. And he says it's cut itself off almost, except for a thread, from the deeper sources of life and vitality. And he goes on, sometimes the unconscious erupts into this consciousness. Often it's in a violent and disruptive way. And it's a conflict between the ego-centered intellect and the deeper, even the transpersonal, psychic and spiritual life deep down within ourselves. So what I'd like to do is contrast that description with then how he describes, how Bhante Sangharakshita describes the integrated person, which he calls the true individual. So a true individual is someone who has developed self-awareness through one discipline or another, and on that basis has a confidence and self-respect that does not depend upon convention or fashion. If you are a true individual, your sense of identity and purpose in life does not rely on your social identity, whether you are a citizen, family member, worker, rebel, or iconoclast. As a mature human being, your self-awareness transcends human social groups of all kinds. Your defining relationship is an inner relationship with the deeper reality of things, the truth behind appearances. One might even say that the true individual is one through whom that deeper reality of things functions and is present in the world. If you are a true individual, you can stand on your own two feet and at the same time maintain a harmony with the way things really are. So I like the contrast between those two quotes. And if you like, that is what, in some way, we may not even define it in that kind of way, but in some way that is what we all do, try and move from one to the other in a sense. And that is life. I was talking to Jenny earlier, she used this lovely word, transition. Life as transition. And, you know, that... what I really like about Sangharakshita as well, that he says the most interesting thing really about this idea of the true individual is that it's always in relation with other people. So it's something that, although you can do some things on your own, really the process of integration is sort of a collective one, in a way. So what I'd like to do is, I'd just like to suggest a few ways in which we can do this on this event on this retreat, in our lives in general. So the first one I've just called Living with the Green Man. So I just moved John's little green man mask here up to the front. So we've got, in a way, we've got two green men, and they're slightly different, but I'd like to draw out just a few of the correspondences between them of how we could sort of live with the green man. So, I mean, we're doing it in a way, living on a field like this for either for the, you know, for the weekend or for the week, and bring as much kind of presence to being on here as you can. Pay attention to each other. Notice the breeze, the grass, the trees, the sky. I mean, it's so lovely. Most of the time, we live with a roof over our heads. And, I mean, it sometimes can be a bit uncomfortable, living outdoors. But I think it also can be very integrating. So we're doing that in a way. Both of these figures associated, as I think I mentioned last night, with the kind of mythic north and with the forest. And I think even just contemplating the forest and what that means to you. I was thinking, I mean, it's a shame in a way. I don't know of any forest in this country that's big enough to get lost in. But there's something about being in the forest that is somehow quite satisfying, but it can be a bit frightening as well. And there's this colour green. I mean, when I think of the green man, the pagan green man, I was trying to read a bit about this figure over the last few months, and some of what I read wasn't very satisfying. I found it as though this figure was being appropriated by what felt to me a bit something that was a bit kind of flaky. I can't say exactly what it is. What I really like about both of these figures is that they're actually a bit mysterious. Like, that's the impression I got. No one really knows where this green man comes from. There are no clear origins that I've come across anyway in my sort of limited research. And the same with the Mogacity, very mysterious figure. No one really knows where he comes from. I mean, in the Buddhist tradition, these type of figures are said to have come out of a deep meditation of aspect of the historical Buddha's personality. But no one really knows how they arise. But there's something about having figures, if you like, that are mysterious, which I think is really important. Because I think that when Sangharakshita was describing that state of disintegration, I think one of the things that can happen is that science, for example, or the rational intellectual way of life, it's been so successful that it's almost like killed mystery. Because things work, like cars and computers and so on, you sort of, when you, this is Sangharakshita talking, but he says when you explain something or think you've explained something, you think you have mastery over it, and then you stop valuing it. Kind of quite an interesting way of thinking about things. So, having some things that retain a sense of mystery, I think, is really important, that are kind of a bit ungraspable. You can't quite, fully explain them. I mean, just to defend science for a moment, if I read The New Scientist or watch those, I don't know if they're still on, I used to watch these Open University science programs on at 3 o'clock in the morning. The people who are right at the cutting edge of science see the mystery. Mm. When you look at the quantum physicists and so on, they see the mystery. The further they go with it, the more unexplainable it seems to get to them. But it's almost like the kind of practical applications, it's almost like we explain them away really easily. A light switch and a light bulb, it always seems to work. Just finally, on the colour green, I mentioned colour green yesterday as this kind of synthesis of the blue of the sky and the yellow of the earth. But also, green itself is a very kind of a pacifying colour. It's worth just having, we kind of know that, but it's worth just sort of reminding ourselves of that. Of what, or just thinking of what associations you have of green, of the colour green. So that's the first thing, anyway, living with the green man. The second thing, this is very sort of obvious and Buddhist, but it's just to do with the mindfulness of breathing, the meditation that we do. in the Buddhist tradition, it's the classic meditation for integration. In other words, bringing our kind of energies together. And there's something, I mean, just integration in general, something I find very inspiring about kind of gathering oneself together. It's a kind of have a sense of kind of confidence and stability. So, in fact, when we do the mindfulness of breathing from now on, if I'm what I'm going to suggest, and I'll probably say this, if I'm leading it, is that you imagine yourself becoming more integrated with others as you do that practice. Every time your attention is just on that natural rhythm of the breath, something is kind of happening, something which is more than just that. A kind of sort of psychic integration is going on. And so we'll try and do that meditation with that flavour, if you like, as we go on. So the third thing I want to suggest is just a kind of contemplation of the double Vajra. It's a very lovely shape, I find. It's a very kind of harmonious shape. And, obviously it's that shape for a reason. And I think I've been doing this a little bit, which is just like imagining that shape in my mind, sometimes as something vast in the sky. And I think that there is something that goes on in just kind of imagining harmonious, stable forms that also helps us to kind of gather ourselves. I mean, there is another thing here. I mean, that shape in particular I really like, but the Tibetan word for Vajra is Dorje, and Dorje means the Lord of Stones. And when some of you know, I've just been up in Scotland. In fact, I took this picture with me to Scotland to do a kind of solitary meditation retreat. And I went right up to the north of Scotland, as far as you can go. And from the beach there, I took some stones. And this is my favourite one here. So this is my Lord of Stones. It's from Strathay Point, which is kind of midway in the north coast. There's no one up there. There's no one there. I mean, Scotland's fantastic for that. So I brought that stone back. So, of course, that's a different shape, but I kind of, there's something very pleasing about that as well. So in a way, it's just like thinking of forms that are kind of satisfying, pleasing, integrating to you. I mean, in the Indian tradition, the Vajra was most commonly a disc with a hole in the middle. So, and I just mentioned that because when you see us playing frisbee, that's what we'll be doing. We'll be contemplating the another form of the Vajra.
The other one.
thanks for that, Carol. Yeah, needed that. So, and the fourth thing that I'd like to suggest, the fourth and final thing, is creating mandalas. So a mandala, in fact, I've got a definition somewhere. Let me see if, did I? Yeah. Very short definition, but I'll read it word for word because it's very lovely. In the sense, this double Vajra is a form of a mandala. It's a very common form, actually, where you have something in the middle and then you have something on these cardinal points, north, south, west and east. It can take other forms, but that's probably the most common one. Sangharakshita quotes a Tibetan teacher, Rong Zompa Chokyi Zangpo, whoever he is, like his name though. And he says, to make a mandala is to take any prominent aspect of reality and surround it with beauty. Mm. So I'd really like to, I've been doing a bit of this these last weeks. I'd really like to suggest, it's something that we can do individually and collectively. So individually, you can think of what, you know, what is at the centre of your life. You can both do this as a kind of what is actually at the centre and as an aspiration. Something I remember doing in a, like a Buddhist class years ago, maybe a decade or more ago, and it was something very satisfying about it. And then you arrange around that all the other aspects of your life. And you can do this, you can just do it with words. You can put a word in the middle and just arrange words, or you can do it with images, you can do it with anything you like. What I particularly like about it in relation to this double Vajra as the unification of opposites is that you can put things around it or think of things imaginatively that appear to be contradictions. Because actually we're all made up, you know, we're full of contradictions. And there's something about this symbolism of the mandala as a kind of personal and collective psyche, that is what we are. You know, we are a bundle, if you like, of contradictions. Mm-hmm. And why I like the language of integration so much is because rather than thinking of kind of one's life as like you have to just kind of like go along this very tight and narrow path and sort of hack bits of your psyche off. Again, to use Bhante Sangharakshita's language in somewhere, you have this idea that you kind of expand with love and awareness. You know, individually and collectively, we expand ourselves to include all of those contradictions. It's a much more kind of ebullient language for me. Something about it that is very satisfying. I mean, obviously, within that, you're trying to you know, not act out of hatred and anger and so on. There are things we're trying not to do. But there's something about, in Jungian language, about not being afraid of our shadow. You know, we all have a kind of shadow side. It's one of the Jungian archetypes. And there's something it can be, we can have so much kind of guilt and shame attached to it, that somehow this language, using the mandala, using this language of integration, means you can just can feel a bit more at ease with this, you know, the kind of darker sides of ourselves, as it were. So by contradiction is a kind of just anything that is apparently opposite within ourselves. You could pick almost anything in a way, and there's usually within us there's something which is its opposite, yeah, as a tendency, as a habit, as a anything really, an aspiration. So that's today, and then tomorrow, as I said, I'm going to look at a bit more at some fearlessness and this mudra called the Abhaya mudra, the mudra or gesture of fearlessness.